Welcome back to Principles of Environmental Toxicology. I'm Greg Muller, once again, the instructor for the course. Well, each discipline, each sub-discipline has its own basis in terms of the words it uses, how it executes a particular area of study, and toxicology is no different. Today's lecture, Concepts in Toxicology, is again a little bit more of the fundamentals of toxicology and environmental toxicology, help you lay a foundation so that when we use certain words such as acute, chronic, for example, in terms of toxicosis, you'll know kind of what we mean, the context again, the definitions. Some people will refer to this as jargon, science speak perhaps. What it is, in fact, it's efficiency of the communication. What each discipline does is it establishes a lexicon to describe those concepts that are most important to further study in that particular discipline. This is what we're going to do today. In terms of our learning objectives, what we're going to do is define toxicology and toxicity. What a wonderful place to start in terms of a course, Principles of Environmental Toxicology. We'll try to discuss some different types of toxic responses. We won't go through a very large list. We'll actually save that for a further lecture. We'll talk about the array of particular endpoints of toxicosis that may impact an organism. We'll explain how toxicants are classified. For example, pesticides. That is a chemical series that kills pests, if you will. We're going to try to describe the phases of toxicosis to give you an understanding, an introductory understanding to things like toxicodynamics, toxicomechanics, the absorption phase, the elimination phase, for example. We'll try to explain some concomitant exposure influences. For example, if an organism is in a state of ill health, it may not have the adequate biochemical, physiological response mechanisms to fight off a low-grade toxicity. And so we'll talk about that as well. The idea is to develop an introductory understanding of toxicity and toxicity testing. What we're not going to do, we're going to do it in the reading, is actually talk about or discover a little bit more about, for instance, the rat trials, the rodent assays that we've introduced that are key in terms of identifying some of the potential toxic impacts, critical lethal doses, critical effective doses in terms of all sorts of chemicals that we are exposed to in our daily life, including things that are in our food system by choice, things like food additives, the colors that make a food product a little bit more attractive, give us a sensory feedback, as well as the exogenous substances that come in through nature via contamination. All of these are subjects for today's Concepts in Toxicology lecture. What is toxicology? It is the science that deals with the adverse effects of chemicals in living systems. There is also a sub-area of that definition, perhaps a sub-definition, that also discusses the probability that those toxic endpoints will happen. One of the things that's important, and we'll get to that as we discuss the quantitative relationship between dose and response, is that you can be dosed with a toxicant but below an effect level, below a response level. In other words, your system has the capacity to detoxify or to not have a clinical endpoint. And so we'll talk about these quantitative relationships indeed. Now, in terms of the classifications of toxicology, descriptive toxicology tells us about the what. Mechanistic toxicology tells us about the why of toxicology. And analytical toxicology, which you see in the CSI type programs with laboratory analyses of poisons, for example, in a criminal investigation. This is analytical toxicology. It tells us how much. We screen for potential toxicants in terms of potential poisoning. And we do this also in terms of looking at risk assessment. What is the concentration of potential toxicants in, for example, our air, our water, and our food? Definition of toxicity is also helpful, and this is the degree to which a substance can harm human or animals. And so there is a variability, and we'll define some of the variability towards the end of today's lecture in terms of things that are low toxicity versus highly toxic chemicals. If you can at home, people tell you how to can so that you can prevent the appearance of a bacterial toxin, for example. So these things, and this is a highly lethal bacterial toxin. Toxicity as can be subclassified as an acute, subchronic, or chronic toxicity, and actually there is even some subclassifications within those terms, subacute, for example. We're not going to go into all of them. We will define these three, however. Acute toxicity involves the harmful effects in an organism through a single or short-term exposure. The focus here is on exposure. Now recognize that, for example, in this colorful illustration of the death of Socrates, in my Fulbright experience in Greece, I was able to visit the prison of Socrates. We have a Socrates lecture in this course, and one of the reasons we named it the Socrates lecture, because his untimely death was by execution, and the choice of execution in ancient Athens for people outspoken such as Socrates was by drinking an elixir of conium. Conium being the active alkaloid in poison hemlock, okay? Now this is an acute exposure, right? So you drink the cup of this extremely toxic brew and you have a very, very acute toxicosis, if you will. There are, for example, acute exposures, very short term, you brush up against a poison ivy. That exposure can have a toxic end effect that lasts, in some cases, minutes, days, weeks, months. There are other sorts of acute exposures where one exposure, and I like to give the example of, for instance, delayed neuropathy from exposure to an organophosphorus insecticide, where you may have a very large-scale acute exposure, one-time exposure, accidental farm worker accident, for example, that has chronic toxicity for the rest of that individual's life in terms of delayed neuropathy. Okay, so acute exposures can have acute end effects but also chronic end effects, and there's a little bit of difference, but the acute toxicity is one that is extremely rapid in terms of the onset of toxicosis from the exposure. Subchronic toxicity is the ability of a toxic substance to cause effects for more than 1 year, and that's a little bit of a sloppy term in terms of putting actual months on it, but it gives you some instance we're talking about on the order of months or short years, but less than a lifetime. And so subchronic is something that it's the effects level that is extending, and typically it's associated with either an acute or a series of short amounts of dosing, sometimes small amounts of dosing, but typically when we're talking about chronic toxicity, we're talking about something that is longer term exposure, longer term toxicity. Chronic toxicity is best defined as the ability of a substance or a mixture of substances to cause harmful effects over an extended period. And this is characterized usually by repeated doses. And so this is where, for example, if you drank contaminated water from your faucet, and this was something that was undiscovered for a long period of time, this would be kind of a chronic exposure, okay? Low level typically, and quite often these chronic sort of toxicoses are not necessarily life-threatening, because what happens is if you are exposed to an acutely toxic substance, you're going to have acute toxicosis, an acute episode, which usually makes you stop or limit that particular behavior. Chronic toxicosis quite often is one that builds up over time. Mercury toxicosis in terms of neurotoxicity for mercury is something that typically is a foodborne intoxication over a long period of time, typically on the order of years. This effect in terms of the exposure and the effects will last towards the lifetime of the particular exposed individual. One of the things we want to do in toxicology, just to give you a background, again, just to kind of familiarize yourself with all of the sub-disciplines, if you will, of toxicology, is talk about the types of areas of study and the types of people that explore the interaction, the interface, if you will, between chemistry and biology. On this list, as we go through this, many students will identify with an area of interest in their own academic preparation. For example, wildlife biologists will have an interest in wildlife toxicology. But in terms of how people kind of exercise their scholarship, their study, their investigations, or just their job in terms of examining the different areas of toxicology, there are subcategories of toxicologists that study target organs or target systems. For example, we probably have all heard of neurotoxins, and the people in the area of study is neurotoxicology. We have genetic toxicology, reproductive toxicology, immunotoxicology, the ability of chemical substances to have an impact on your immune system. Typically that impact is the ability of a chemical to diminish your immune response to infectious agents. Endocrine toxicology becoming more and more important. You probably have seen incidences reported in the media, which is very highlighted quite often in magazine articles or newspaper articles when scientists identify, for example, confined populations, perhaps in a lake or sometimes even in a reach of a river, of fish that have had some endocrine disruption or estrogenic effects, allowing for for example, appearance of female secondary sexual characteristics in chromosomally identified males of the species. We can also examine toxicology from a target species, target systems point of view. Aquatic toxicologists will deal primarily, I would have to say, with fish, although many things aquatic, the life aquatic. Environmental toxicologists are a broader subdiscipline. These folks look at the sources, pathways, receptors, and controls of chemicals in our environment. Wildlife toxicologists typically come from a wildlife biology background, animal management background, but look at the interaction, for example, of humans and industrial pollution, as well as naturally occurring toxicants. And they get to manage quite often the relationship between chemicals as nutrients or vitamins and minerals in terms of the array of concentrations from nutritional deficiency to toxicity of those particular minerals. For example, if we have grazing ungulates that are grazing in an area of naturally occurring high selenium, like South Dakota, there is a potential for toxicosis. Those same species of animals grazing in the higher elevations of the Rocky Mountains in Colorado may actually have selenium deficiency because of the lack of selenium in the particular forage in that particular area. Veterinary toxicology is typically a diagnostic clinical area of expertise. These individuals are typically DVMs that have additional study in the area of toxicology, typically a master's and more often than not a PhD in toxicology or a related field. These individuals will work with clinicians in terms of the practical diagnosis of potential toxicosis in animal populations. So this can be someone's cat who ate a bottle of aspirin, a dog that ate chocolate bars, cattle that broke a fence and got into a potato field and have alkaloid poisoning, or many other sorts of potential wildlife or production livestock or pet animal toxicoses. We can also classify toxicologists and the subdisciplines of toxicology in terms of selected responses. Teratology looks at malformation of the conceptus based on some sort of toxic impact to the molecules of life, DNA, RNA. And carcinogenesis, oncologists, if you will, that study cancer and the initial stages of cancer that are related to chemical exposure. Now, in terms of the various fields that people go into in toxicology, applied toxicology fields include occupational toxicology. I'll often say it in this course that workplace exposure is one of the greatest areas of concern because this is day in, day out, 8-hour exposure of airborne contaminants in the workplace. If you're in a manufacturing environment, people get concerned, for example, with the fumes coming out of Xerox copy machines. There's been some concern over the past couple decades about those sorts of things. all of the chemicals that we are around on a constant and consistent basis in terms of exposure. But workplace exposure, for example, in farm workers and pesticides, this is a high level, high concentration, concentrated product exposure in terms of pesticides and agricultural chemicals, as opposed to you and I that might get exposed to trace residues in a food product that we're consuming. So it's a different level of exposure, a different dose, if you will. Clinical toxicologists look at the toxic-induced diseases and antidotes, sometimes trained in emergency medicine, poison control centers. This is typically a human medical environment. These are the individuals that get called into consultancies in terms of rapid response to either accidental or, in some cases, intentional or suicidal ingestion. And sometimes it's things like drug overdoses from people that do various types of illicit drugs. There are forensic toxicologists, again, folks that are involved in follow-up of toxicoses as related, especially quite often, to determining causes of death in a criminal environment or a potential legal environment. Forensic toxicologists also look at environmental toxicology. For example, if you are in a coastal community and you have an oil slick wash up on your shore, there's a great amount of ocean out there. Where did this oil come from? And forensic environmental toxicologists will actually profile the petroleum hydrocarbons in that particular oil slick and try to trace it back or fingerprint it to a particular source, whether that's a source of oil or a tanker. Regulatory toxicologists are the ones that review the data sets submitted by various industries that are intending to use chemicals in the marketplace. These chemical uses can be, for example, agricultural chemicals, they can be pharmaceuticals, they can be industrial chemicals in terms of new chemicals that might impact your living environment or our environment as a total. What these individuals do is they take a look at very broad-based sources, pathways, receptors, and controls. They try to look at life cycle assessment, they look at the medical or the clinical data, the animal studies. They have certain key indicators of potential toxicosis. Regulatory toxicologists will be concerned primarily about protection of human health, but there is also a protection of the environment initiative in terms of regulatory toxicology here in the United States. What is quite interesting is how we are starting to globalize the processes of regulatory toxicology. One thing I'll tell you, having traveled a little bit in terms of international travel, is that our regulatory system, EPA or FDA, is typically held up by the rest of the world in very, very high regard for the efficiency, for the types of data. When our FDA or EPA rule on a chemical, I would say there is a tremendous number of countries out there that take that as the truth. And so, and quite often, they will adopt the recommendation of the US EPA and FDA. Is that uniform acceptance? No. In fact, many industrialized countries have their own sets of standards. But typically, there is harmonization, another term for you, of the rules and regulations about chemical use in the environment and in the human food chain. There is typically need for some sort of harmonization just because of global trade and because of transboundary relationships between countries. These individuals will be involved in risk assessment. We talked about the risk assessment triad, and you remember all of the risk analysis sectors of how a process of risk analysis is performed from our introductory lecture. Developmental toxicologists will take a look at new chemicals and their uses. What we do in developmental toxicology is make sure that there aren't any key critical next generation or inheritable end effect responses of toxicosis. There have been some classic failures in this over the past 100 years. DES, diethylstilbestrol, given to pregnant women to ease nausea, but ended up causing birth defects in the conceptus, is probably the most classic example of developmental toxicosis, and our regulatory system, if you will, not having the, at that point in time, sufficient oversight and review prior to a chemical being used in a pharmaceutical application. We can also classify toxicants in many ways. We can do them by the target organ, so we'll refer to some chemicals as hepatotoxins because they have a direct impact on your liver. We'll in fact have a whole lecture on target organ toxicity. So when we talk about neurotoxicity, we'll talk about the fundamental chemical reactions, for example, of how cholinesterase inhibitors actually bind irreversibly, somewhat irreversibly, to the enzyme, the neurotransmitter enzyme cholinesterase. We can classify toxicants in terms of their intended uses, so you'll hear us refer to pesticides, solvents, for example, with biocides. We'll refer to toxicants sometimes as natural or synthetic. We try not to bias that. It's just a label in terms of its source in our environment, in our food chain. What I would like students in this course to do is walk away with an understanding that it's the chemical, it's not necessarily the manufacturer, whether it be nature or humans, but the chemical that deserves the respect in terms of potential for toxicosis. As I'm often said, nature is very, very good at poisoning us, and in many cases, much, much better than anything we could devise or invent in terms of our industrial chemistry. We can classify toxicants by their special effects. So you've probably all heard about carcinogenic chemicals, mutagenic chemicals. We can have endocrine disruptors, we can have estrogenic disruptors, and so there's many different ways that we can describe that, and typically by that's chemicals, toxic end effect. One of the reasons, by the way, I put an alligator here, many of you at this point kind of wonder why we have an alligator in terms of a classification of toxicants. One of the major studies involved in endocrine disruption was actually done on newborn alligators in Lake Apopka, Florida. Lake Apopka was a very polluted lake in Florida, and some of the 1980s work that looked at the relationship of chemicals in a confined environment like Lake Apopka and the relationship to, in this case, feminization of the male offspring of alligators in this particular ecosystem. We can also classify toxicants in terms of their physical states. So we can talk about gas phase toxicants, like the toxicant in Bhopal, India, solids in terms of, like this chemical here, this is acme. Arsenate of lead. It was an actively used insecticide in fruit orchards, actually here in the Northwest. It was a potent chemical. In fact, the legacy of lead arsenate is significant in the level of soil contamination, residual soil contamination of many orchard lands and other agricultural lands where this was used. Arsenic is fairly mobile. It has the impact of potentially going down a groundwater, but it also can be bioalkylated by bacteria and fungi and essentially mobilize away from this particular impact environment. However, lead is somewhat immobile, and typically the residual lead concentrations in these soils make it difficult for some farmers to actually, usually it's a real estate transaction. If you want to convert a farm field into, for instance, a residential area, you have fairly highly contaminated soils. And this issue has developed in many instances in the Northwest because of the historical use of this compound. We can talk about a chemical in terms of its toxicity. So, for example, on the list towards the end of today's lecture, we'll talk about, for example, slightly or low toxic chemicals, extremely toxic chemicals. And this has to do with key critical indicators of its toxicity, its behavior in terms of the quantitative relationship of dose and response. We can talk about chemicals in terms of classifying them, from their chemical composition. So we will hear the term heavy metal, for example. Why quite often, and coming from a chemistry background, I take a look at the periodic table and I worry most in terms of toxicosis about that middle transition element. These are where our heavy metals are. We can talk about, for example, organophosphate, insecticides, and so you'll hear that compositional description of a toxicant. We can also talk about toxicants from their mechanism of action. Anticholinergic, for example, that interact with the neurotransmitter receptors in terms of neurotoxic chemicals. It can be a cholinesterase inhibitor, where it actually works it on a different side of the neurotransmission on the enzyme that essentially quiets the response after the initial depolarization of the neuron. We can talk about chemicals being uncouplers, uncoupling key critical enzymatic pathways like the Krebs cycle. We'll show some examples in this course of chemicals that turn off key critical biochemical cycles with very toxic end effects. Now, if we classify the types of toxic responses, we can talk about them. You've probably heard of, and I've introduced these terms a little bit in this course already, local or systemic effects. If I rub up against a poison ivy bush, I get a localized dermatitis, some blistering on my arm. Some of us will have an immune cascading response and start showing blistering or systemic effects from this particular toxic action at different parts of our body. A snake bite is an example of a systemic. There will be local inflammation, local necrosis at the area of the bite, but the protein venom will actually circulate through and start a systemic response throughout the organism. So local is going to be at the site of contact, and that can be the gastrointestinal tract in terms of localized intoxication. If we breathe a very toxic chemical, for example, a chemical in Bhopal actually mixes with the water. It's a plasticizer. It was used by Union Carbide. It actually had a devastating response because it was very reactive with water. As you breathe in, your lung tissues are very moist. There was chemical reaction at the surface of your lung tissue and respiratory failure. With systemic responses, those effects can be distant from the exposure site. For example, I might eat something that's a gastrointestinal tract, but that something that I might have eaten that has a toxic response, for instance, target organ toxicity, for instance, a kidney toxin, nephrotoxin. These can be typically classified as CNSers, central nervous system toxins, nephrotoxins, respiratory toxins. We can find that, and it's not that uncommon to have both localized and systemic effects in toxic responses. Some of the responses can be classified as immediate, and that can be minutes to hours after a single exposure, and some of them can be delayed, and these can be days to years after exposure. We all kind of understand at this point that carcinogenesis is typically a delayed response to an acute or chronic exposure to a carcinogen. Cancer is a disease of decades. You don't get skin cancer from going out and getting one sunburn and then see a cancer spot basal cell or melanoma show up the next day. We might take a decade or more for that development to occur. Both local and systemic and immediate delayed can occur in any particular kind. So sometimes we just use these terms, especially when they are, for example, specific to a particular toxin or toxicant. We can also look at toxic responses and classify them as reversible or irreversible. The reversibility of a toxic response is determined by the types of tissue involved. Hepatotoxins, for example, your liver is largely a regenerable organ in terms of the structures and function of it. It is used to a lot of damage. It's one of the primary organs for detoxification. So So in a certain sense, this first guard gets a lot of assault, insult, toxic insult, if you will. And in terms of our evolutionary strategy, because it is our first line of defense, it does have a significant amount of regeneration capacity. The length of exposure and the magnitude of the toxic insult is a part of whether or not an intoxication will be reversible. Reversible toxicoses, again, are regenerating type tissues, intestinal mucosa. If you've ever absorbed a particularly toxic material, or for instance, in bacterial toxigenesis, had a bacterial infection, those bacterial toxins will have a dramatic insult in terms of the lining of your stomach and gastrointestinal tract. And in fact, because of, again, evolutionary strategy of diet and the relative uncontrolled aspect of historical diets, these tissues need to be rapidly regenerating. Once the toxic insult has passed, these tissues need to be able to self-heal. Blood cells are another one. The average lifespan of a blood cell is something on the red blood cell is something on the order of 90 to 120 days. So there's this programmed replacement of a cellular tissue. Irreversible. Quite often, central nervous system damage is irreversible, even with antidotes, and there are antidotes for some neurotoxins. There is the ability to have, for example, this delayed neuropathy. Carcinogenesis is irreversible, uncontrolled cell growth. We'll do an entire lecture on these types of toxic end effects, mutagenesis and teratogenesis as well. The photo up here is from an embryo grebe. This particular toxic insult was a high level of selenium. Selenium is in the same group 6 as sulfur, and can, in high concentration, displace selenium in fundamental biochemicals. Disulfide bonds, disulfide bridges, and protein folding can get interrupted by selenium substituting for those sulfurs. Selenium can also substitute into amino acids. For example, cysteine, which is a sulfur-bearing amino acid, can be substituted by selenocysteine. What happens is typically, this is a reproductive toxin because the next generation will have too much selenium, and quite often this is a soft tissue toxicosis. In this case, you see a deformed beak associated with disulfide bond interruption in beak formation. We can also talk about toxins and toxicants in terms of their bioavailability. For example, if I am exposed to lead, a lead assay, for example, in soil or water will be a total lead, but we know that lead can exist as many species. It can be a lead salt, it can be lead metal. Is the car battery in our car a toxic source? Well, it could be if we decided to try to eat lead metal, or we rub that lead in our hands, or breathe the lead dust, maybe in manufacturing. Lead oxides that exist in soils have a different bioavailability, and because it's not as available, for example, the overall dose of lead as just total lead will be different from the bioavailable dose of lead. And so some of the lead will actually pass through, for example, our gastrointestinal tract. So bioavailability is a way to consider the availability of particular toxins to the organism via typical routes of exposure. In organic chemicals, for example, solvents or pesticides, we can look at something called the octanol water partition coefficient. Partition coefficients, and we'll talk about several of them towards the end of the course as we start getting into chemodynamics and fate and transport ideas in terms of chemistry and environmental chemistry of toxicants. Partition coefficients allow us to empirically look at where a chemical will be. For example, we've talked about the liposphere. Why have we talked about the liposphere? Because some nonpolar chemicals like DDT are very fat soluble. So if you, for example, take a look at a pond and there are fish in that pond, think of the fish as being sticks of butter. Like likes like. So nonpolar chemicals like DDT, like PCBs, like dioxins are going to like that stick of butter called a fish and not like the water, which is a nonpolar medium. And so the octanol water partition coefficient, KOW, is an interesting way just to kind of introduce this partitioning of chemicals. Where is it? In fact, many people in environmental chemistry partition the environment. They draw boxes. In a certain sense, we as an organism are another box on that model. And this allows us to break down into interface relationships, for instance, between air and water. What about a volatile chemical that's in the water? Will it be released to air at what rate? So KOW allows us to give us some sort of empirical solubility analysis to look at, among other things, transmembrane movement. And what are we? Our largest organ is skin, right? And our skin is nothing more than a membrane. That membrane is in part water. We all try and keep our skin moist, but there is also lipid there. And so as this 80%, 20% ratio of water to other things in our membranes, and we need to go back to introductory biology and remember lipid membranes and the fatty acids involved in cells and cell walls. But as it turns out that we can take a look at these empirical terms like KOW, log KOW as well. This is a very simple analysis. This would be if we wanted to study a chemical. We take a test tube and we fill it half with water, half with O is octanol. Octanol is a very heavy, almost lipid-like solvent. And very simply, we put a chemical in there, we shake it up and see if the chemical likes the very nonpolar, the octanol phase, or the polar water phase. And usually in many chemicals, there's a little bit in each of the layers. The amount that you'll find in the octanol or the water partition in a KOW experiment is a function of the chemical itself. Is it ionized? If it is, it's probably going to be in the water phase. Is it nonpolar? It's probably going to be in the octanol phase. It doesn't mean there won't be any in the water phase, for example, but it will be preferentially. And so this will tell us where it might be in terms of bioavailability in an organism. Now, for example, when we look at chemicals like DDT and we analyze the lipid of an individual, we find the predominant mass of DDT is sequestered in the body fat of the individual. So if we calculate these log KOWs, and these are simple laboratory benchtop experiments, a little bit of octanol, a little bit of water, shake it up and find out which phase it's in. This gives us an idea of where we might find chemicals in the environment and within organisms, but also its potential for transmembrane movement. Because remember that our the epithelial cells on our skin, the epithelial cells in our respiratory tract, or the epithelial cells in our gastrointestinal tract, are all have a lipid bilayer, okay? And so what is an empirical way to kind of look at what is the good property of KOW in terms of transmembrane movement? We find that that's typically in the area of a log KOW of 2 to 3. That's 10 to the second to 10 to the third. And that means that it's more in the octanol phase than in the water phase. And so things that are a little bit more lipid soluble by 100-fold or so are good in terms of transmembrane movement. Now there are other factors in your readings in your book. We'll talk about some of those other factors, the size, the conformation, the charge of the chemical that assists transmembrane movement. But as we find this particular indicator of bioavailability, as we define it and study it, we can use it again as an empirical way to kind of understand these chemicals. The formula at the bottom gives you how to calculate the concentration of a chemical that's in the octanol phase divided by the concentration that's in the water to give you a KOW. An example of this is a chemical, N,N-diethyl-3-methylbenzamide. It's also called diethyl toluamide, or DEET. It's something that, for example, many students will have used at one point in their life. DEET came to us in the early part of the 1900s, about 1930, I believe, it started coming into use as an insect repellent. As far as my readings, they still really don't know how it works. As it is, does turn out diethyl toluamide, or DEET, actually has a very good KOW in terms of transmembrane movement. The log KOW is 2.18. For example, that means that when you rub this on there, not only will you get an impact in terms of keeping the bugs away, but there is transmembrane movement. So there will be systemic circulation absorption of this particular chemical. Now, it has low toxicity. However, toxicity is a function of dose. And in the clinical records, there are examples of misuse of this particular product. For example, parents that that treat their young children, spray them down, for example, every night in some environments. There have been clinical reports of tonic-clonic seizures. It does cross the blood-brain barrier. We'll talk about that in terms of some of the aspects of how things cross these critical barriers. But DEET does have potential impact. In the late 80s, there was a commercial product, pet flea and tick spray, by a major brand name that was called into question because animals treated with this, and again, here's a pet owner that is perhaps not following the label, treating repeatedly at high dose, and these animals were going into seizures and in some cases dying. There's also the aspect of these chemicals that have this transdermal absorption. They have the ability to co-solvate other chemicals and draw them in with them. And this concept has been used in transdermal drug delivery. For example, DEET is one chemical, dimethyl sulfoxide is another chemical. You mix the pharmaceutical in or some other chemical that you want to treat the individual with into the solvent carries it across that membrane, you get transdermal drug delivery. Anyone that's ever experienced a nicotine patch knows about transdermal drug delivery. And so this is, again, just an example of a pesticide that's in common use that we put on ourselves. And I like to make sure people kind of know and understand that when we use chemicals, we use them for desired effects, and we hope to minimize the undesirable effects. And quite often, the undesirable effects are minimized by following the labels. But even still, you can be a part of that hypersensitive population that has dramatic toxicosis, whereas the rest of the population will have minimal negative impacts. Now, if we take a look at toxicology, we can break it up into three phases: the exposure phase, the toxicokinetic phase, and the toxicodynamic phase. And each one of these we'll talk about, and in following lectures, ensuing lectures, we'll be able to kind of look at different aspects of toxicosis and how those aspects actually are able to be studied and kind of analyzed, sometimes in a quantitative way. The picture here is actually a local picture of a nearby cemetery. I thought it was interesting that here in an area where essentially death and the celebration of life, if you will, in terms of gravestones, is all around, that there was a volunteer growth of poison hemlock in a somewhat macabre example of a local toxic plant. In terms of the exposure phase, it's dominated by bioavailability, and that's the fraction of the dose that might be available for absorption. So in terms of respiratory toxicosis, how much is absorbed with each breath? In terms of GIT, how much is absorbed through the intestinal lining? Some of that can be facilitated absorption if, for instance, the toxicant, like lead, goes and hijacks, if you will, the calcium absorption pathways. Some of the main factors in the exposure phase are the time and frequency of exposure. For example, we talked about acute and subchronic, and the route of administration of the toxicant. In animals, that can be oral, lung scan injection, for instance. Sometimes in toxicological studies, toxicologists will do something, for example, called intraperitoneal. They'll actually inject the toxicant into the abdominal cavity of an animal, and the idea is to study it without any possible transformation, for example, in terms of oral ingestion of a particular chemical. It's one way to look at the relationship of a chemical to potential and effect toxicosis. Plants, and we will deal a little bit in terms of plants, but we won't really do that in terms of comparative toxicology in this course, but respect that in terms of how toxicants are initially absorbed into these organisms. It's through the roots and the leaves, stomatal pores typically, through some of the surface cells. The exposure phase is dominated by the dose, so how much is a quantitative aspect, and again we'll try to define that significantly in a full lecture on dose response relationships. The physical and chemical form of the toxicant, things like particle size, solubilization, is it particularly soluble or not? There can be host-related factors in terms of the health of the host and whether or not that the ability of that host to fight off that particular toxic insult. For example, if you're an individual that has diminished immune function because of malnutrition, that is typically going to set you up for a more significant toxic response to an insult than somebody that's in a well-nourished, healthier environment. For example, in carcinogenesis, and it's been estimated that we get about 100,000 hits of mutagenesis per day, normally, naturally, in our bodies. These are our cell differentiation activities on a cellular basis. Our immune system is pretty good at detecting bad path cells and formations, if our immune system is compromised in some way from disease or malnutrition, we have the inability to kind of self-manage these normally occurring malformations, these uncontrolled differentiating cells. This picture, you may have read about this in the past few years. This was Ukrainian President Viktor Yushchenko, a very classic and unfortunate case study in poisoning. There's obviously some political intrigue in terms of his political opponents and how exactly this dioxin poisoning happened. What he experienced was classic chloracne. It's dioxin or hydrocarbon, chlorinated hydrocarbon toxicosis in the initial stages. These pustules appear on your face and sometimes body depending upon the degree of intoxication. This particular level of chloracne suggests that this individual had a very, very high dose. It probably wasn't acute, but it was high on a relative basis over a short period of time. Not enough to cause some of the neurotoxic impacts of chlorinated hydrocarbons, but enough to cause chloracne. Dioxins, and you'll see the from a dose response point of view, are extraordinarily toxic chemicals. It's very lipophilic in terms of speculating where the dose came from, perhaps an alcoholic beverage in terms of its ability to be diluted, or in his food, probably not in his water. Very unfortunate circumstance, especially considered the potential for carcinogenesis from this particular chemical. The next phase that we'll talk about is the absorption phase of toxicosis. We can use comparative toxicology to look at this in terms of absorption on a cellular basis or absorption on an organism basis. On an organism basis, we're talking about macro absorption, for instance, through lung tissue. On a cellular basis, we're talking about toxicants that cross the cell membrane, either just going, destroying the membrane or passing through the pores or in facilitated transport. We have to know and understand a little bit about membrane morphology, and we'll review this a little bit in our lectures. The lipoprotein bilayer, this critical wall around cells that separates the outside world from the inside world and all the cellular mechanics that we have in biology. destroying that membrane releases those inner chemicals, sometimes enzymes that are extremely bioactive, lysozymes, cellular damage, oxidative stress, and we'll talk a little bit about antioxidants and why mom tells you to eat your fruits and vegetables in terms of in our target organ toxicology. But this is an important potential toxic endpoint. There are some physiochemical processes that will govern transmembrane movement. We talked about the lipid water solubility and log KOW. There can be, for example, ionization of pKa, functional groups, the essentially chemical morphology, including molecular size and conformation, how it will pass through these membranes. There can be, for example, and this is a classic in respiratory toxicosis, particulate migration. And these are macroparticles. They're microscopic in terms of their overall size because on the order of microns, but they can actually pass in through tissues and migrate from one place to another, essentially going into the interstitial spaces between cells. I had a roommate in graduate school, a Nicaraguan individual that had the unfortunate experience of grabbing his coat out of the back of a Jeep after the Managuan earthquake in the 1970s, not realizing there was a shotgun wrapped up in his coat, which fell on the ground and discharged. It hit him in a very tender place, the place where we all sit down, and he got a lot of buckshot in him. He did survive the incident, but for years and perhaps even decades later, he would notice buckshot that would migrate through very odd places in his body, even on his chest, where he'd see a dark spot. And over a period of time, that buckshot had migrated throughout his whole body in terms of just translocation. And so we're not as solid individuals as you might think. We do have lots of pores, cavities, and the ability for particulates to migrate as well. In terms of what governs transmembrane movement, simple diffusion governed by concentration gradients, a fixed law that you learned in freshman chemistry. We'll talk a little bit about that in absorption lectures. We can have filtration, materials that actually go through aqueous pores. They get transported the same way we transport various fluids in our body. They can also be carrier-mediated, carried by other chemicals, either natural or exogenous or endogenous. Sometimes these can be facilitated as well in terms of different enzymes or proteins that are set up to facilitate absorption, for example, of nutrients. They bind the nutrients and allow it to cross membranes in a facilitated way. Sometimes toxicants can play the role of that particular mineral or chemical and get facilitated absorption, essentially hijacking that mechanism. In terms of the sites of absorption, we have in animals the gastrointestinal tract, dermal absorption, lung absorption. In plants, the stomatal pores, the cuticle, and the roots. In insect, we find the pore canals, various oral, if they ingest a particular chemical that might, for instance, be on a food product, a leaf that they're eating might contain an insecticide. Fish have absorption through their gill tissues, gastrointestinal tract, and through dermal absorption, remembering that fish essentially swim in their environment. They have 100% dermal contact with their environment in the same way we have 100% dermal contact with our air. In terms of the distribution phase of toxicology, there's four fates, and this has something to do with the site of toxic action. We then go to storage, then metabolism, and then excretion. These are, in essence, the titles of four of the lectures here in Principles of Environmental Toxicology, where we'll go through step by step how these different fates sequentially happen in toxicosis. How this occurs in terms of transport, in terms of the distribution phase in animals, it gets transported throughout our bodies in blood, which is a very fast flowing fluid, or via the lymph system, which is significantly slower on a respective basis. In plants, it's the xylem and phloem. There are some barriers of toxicological significance. We'll talk about these. Again, I'll introduce you probably or may have heard of the blood-brain barrier. In terms of an evolutionary strategy for survival, we are only as good as our brains are. And so we have many protective mechanisms in our physiology. When we faint due to heat exhaustion, it's to preserve our brain. When we have a blood-brain barrier that keeps out certain types of chemicals, that's because probably in terms of our evolution, there was a selection for those individuals that had increased amounts of cells, and these cells are called astrocytes, we'll talk about them, that have higher fat content and therefore modulate the types of solubility, the types of chemicals that pass through that particular barrier. Isn't it amazing that in terms of offspring and reproduction that women have a placental barrier, in fact, can be intoxicated, yet that placental barrier will protect the fetus. And again, an evolutionary strategy for survival. And there is also a blood-milk barrier, and these all occur with the same sorts of relative lipid level in certain types of cells, certain types of membranes that form these particular barriers. One of the things I want to introduce to you in this is a generalized respect for the variety of toxins. As we talk about the interface of chemistry and biology, biology is often very easy to visualize. Chemistry is a little bit more difficult. When we talk about toxins and toxicosis, I want you to start understanding the incredible variety of chemicals that can have toxic end effects. I put a sea snake neurotoxin up here, which is a protein neurotoxin, to give you an idea of the complexity of some of these chemicals. And one of the challenges I have you do in this particular exercise, this particular lecture module online, is to analyze some structures, some protein structures, to essentially get inside of a 3D representation online at the protein data bank, and get an idea of the receptors that exist and on particular types of biomolecules for intoxication. Some of the factors affecting distribution include the affinity of particular tissues for the xenobiotic. So for example, there will be receptors, there will be chemical structures, there will be different proteins or enzymes that have an impact with a type of toxin. This will yield, in some cases, target organ toxicity. The blood flow to the organ, the liver gets first pass enterohepatic recirculation from the portal vein. So as we eat a toxicant, it gets absorbed. There is a tremendous amount, I think it's 60% if I recall correctly, of your blood flow from your intestines actually goes directly to your liver. This first pass impact with high flow and high impact in terms of the original site of potential interaction sets the liver up for either hepatotoxicity if it can't manage it, or for detoxification if in fact it can manage it quite well. Protein binding will be one of the factors affecting distribution. We set ourselves up for elimination, and as you'll see in our biotransformation lectures and some comments today, that we are very talented in terms of our ability to detoxify many of the chemicals that we are exposed to, either from natural sources or from synthetic sources. The route of administration, the rate of metabolism, if it's something that has a slow rate of metabolism, that chemical is around a lot longer to do some damage if in fact it has high level of bioactivity. There is a potential for redistribution when we do target organ toxicity. You can look up in the resources. I've put a cartoon together in flash animation of enterohepatic recirculation. And this is a quirk, for instance, of our biology, where our liver will actually process materials absorbed through the gastrointestinal tract and transport the liver by the portal vein, getting discharged through the bile ducts and the gallbladder back into the gastrointestinal tract after it's processed. What that can do is set up, because it's an upstream release, this allows for a very efficient absorption and utilization of nutrients. But because toxicants also follow this pathway, there can be a re-exposure in this recirculation that the processed toxicants, and sometimes it's a minor modification to the original chemical, can actually come back to visit you and cycle around and hang out for a while in terms of enterohepatic recirculation. We have the metabolism phase, and we'll do an entire lecture on this. We'll refer to this as your body trying to make grease into salt. One of the things that we want to do is take chemicals that are perhaps have limited solubility and make them more soluble. Why do we want to make them more soluble? So we can eliminate them via the urinary tract primarily. And so bioconversion and biotransformation is an important part of this process. We break it up into two phases. These are typically sequential phases, but they can happen independently, and very different chemicals can undergo very different metabolic processes in terms of the outcome. Typically what we find is that the metabolism of a chemical, the TTR, total toxic residue of a chemical, will actually be found in maybe one metabolite primarily, maybe two, maybe five or six, different chemical structures, different modifications. This is your body converting chemicals from one form to another, in the hopes, at least from a survival strategy point of view, that this transformation detoxifies that particular chemical, makes it less toxic. As it turns out, sometimes, because this is just operating in terms of thermodynamics and drivers of chemistry in terms of available enzymes and cofactors, sometimes your body actually takes something that has relatively low direct toxicity and toxifies it. In other words, it enhances or increases the toxicity of that chemical via this metabolic cycle. Some of the factors affecting this are environmental and genetic. Phase one, as you'll find out, is typically just associated with a functional group change on a molecule to make it more polar. Phase two, this grease to salt conversion, is something that adds a side group to it, typically, for example, a sugar or a sulfate group, and we'll go through these in the chemistry of each of these in fair treatment of a whole lecture. If we go back to dioxin, and we'll just reference this a couple of times in this particular lecture, if you look at this chemical formula here, what you can see is that this is a very nonpolar chemical. This is a very lipophilic chemical. You've got four chlorines. This is TCDD, tetrachlorodibenzodioxin. We're going to do a whole lecture on dioxins and dioxin-like compounds in this course. But this is a very lipid-soluble nonpolar chemical. And so what do you think the body might want to do to this greasy molecule? It's going to try to increase the polarity of it. How would you increase, in terms of, if you go back to basic freshman chemistry, organic chemistry, how do you increase the polarity? Well, you start adding hydroxyl groups, you start adding sugar groups, you start modifying this particular chemical, increase its polarity via these biotransformation reactions, and that is, in essence, phase one, phase two biotransformation. And we'll see some examples in that lecture, and we'll talk about some of the metabolic pathways of dioxin in the dioxin lecture. There are some factors that influence toxicity. We have all seen the movies where someone gets poisoned by one of the actors in the movies, and perhaps you've got 24 hours to live unless you tell me the big secret, and then I'll give you the antidote. What is the antidote? When you think about, you've got poison, you have an intoxicated individual, and you've got an antidote, this magic chemical that is going to reverse or limit the impacts of toxicoses. Well, in terms of the interactions of chemicals, there's four major categories, and these are for concomitant exposures. So this is exposure that happens in a very similar or simultaneous time frame. There is additive toxicity. For example, if we take two organic phosphate chemicals, both have the toxic endpoints of cholinesterase inhibition. In a certain sense, even though we're having two doses of two different chemicals, it's like almost like one dose of one class of chemicals, which are cholinesterase inhibiting OPs. If we look at that as a simple sort of equation, that would be that the toxicity of one chemical might be equivalent to two, the toxicity of the other chemical might be two, and the overall toxicity would be additive, equaling four. We can have synergistic toxicity, and this is where it's more than additive. The sum of the two is more than each individual, and that's can be represented by 2 plus 2 equals 10, a significant enhancement of toxicity. An example of that would be carbon tetrachloride, CCl4, combined with ethanol, leading to hepatotoxicity. Without ethanol, it's still toxic, but it's not as toxic as the combination. There is also potentiation, and that's something that is toxic when you co-administer with something that is can be regarded as non-toxic or low-toxic. 2 plus 0 is equal to 6. An example of that, isopropanol, rubbing alcohol. We put it on our bodies. It's got relatively low toxicity, but combined with carbon tetrachloride, you can have substantial toxicity. We talk about carcinogenesis, we'll talk about tumor promoters, classes of agents that promote cancer, but in and of themselves are not necessarily carcinogenic. We can also have antagonism, and this is our antidotes, and this is a chemical that might even have toxicity in and of itself, but when combined with another chemical, it's a balancing act. It shuts off the toxicity or counters the toxicity with the essentially opposite sort of toxicity. These are quite often used in therapeutic medicine. You can represent this as 2 plus 2 equals 0. BAL is British anti-lewisite. This was an antidote that was carried in World War I by soldiers and the medics on the field for various heavy metal chemical warfare agents that were used in World War I. What this does, it's a binding agent that would bind some of these arsenic type gases that were used. This is your classic sort of antidote chemical that is used, and we'll talk about several antidotes for various types of intoxication. Things, for example, like atropine. Quite often we find is that these antidotes, when given, we can call them antidotes when they're used in a clinical setting, but they can also be in and of themselves toxicants. They still may have some toxicity associated with their individual use. The final step in our phases of toxicology is excretion. We want to get rid of the stuff. So we have all of these exogenous substances in our normal daily diet, naturally occurring chemicals, these plant alkaloids that exist in potatoes, tomatoes, many of our fruits and vegetables, a full range of chemicals that may do us harm in high concentrations. In low concentrations, they may just give us a headache, an upset stomach, or have no effect whatsoever. But we do have the biochemical machinery to enhance their elimination. We want to be able to urinate them, to pee them out. We do find that renal excretion is the primary mechanism. If you don't agree with me in terms of the ability of your urine stream to detoxify and eliminate, I invite you all to have asparagus for dinner tonight and smell your urine tomorrow morning. We'll talk about how that the chemical compounds in there, these sulfur compounds from asparagus actually end up in your urine. We can have non-renal excretion as well. We can have biliary excretion, so we can have direct interaction of the bile processes and the bile acids to emulsify some of these lipophilic products and put them back into your GI tract for fecal elimination. For volatiles, think about this. Your lungs are a very high surface area gas transport membrane. You may not realize this, but your lungs have the surface area of about half of a volleyball court. It's a huge, huge, huge membrane in terms of the surface area. Tremendous potential for gas interchange. If we have a substance in our blood, in our pulmonary system that is volatile, there will be exchange. There are certain chemicals, for example, selenium. If you are exposed to high selenium in your diet, and many of us will take selenium in our vitamin pills because it is a required trace element, high selenium will actually give us a little bit of garlic breath because of the volatile compounds, selenium compounds that are produced in our metabolism. There can be, as well, in terms of excretion, comparative aspects to how animals and plants excrete and detoxify. And in fact, what we find in terms of things like herbicides, there are selective herbicides. For example, if you're in agriculture, there are classifications of broadleaf herbicides. What does that mean? That means that the broadleaf plants don't have the ability to detoxify this toxin, whereas, for example, grasses or some other plants might have the ability to detoxify this particular compound and eliminate it. One of the things we want to learn about is toxicodynamics, and these are the quantitative dose-response relationships, and they have to do with the increase of dose yielding a critical endpoint that leads to toxicosis. We can kind of look at the chain of events in terms of this is why, for example, these toxic chemicals and the modifiers that you hear in the media do not necessarily have a relationship in dosage. What we want to make sure is critical, that a toxic chemical will have a relationship to dosage in terms of a dose-response quantitative relationship. But this toxic chemical will have some sort of key interaction and will modify a some sort of critical physiological or cellular target. This is a key interaction. These key interactions can be subclinical in terms of potential toxicosis. We can have biotransformation, we can have repair, low dose, we can have no observation of toxic endpoint. That key lesion is modified, and that can be tissue necrosis, it can be a change, it can be immunogenesis, whatever, all of these endpoints that we'll review in this particular endpoints lecture. With sufficient dose, we can have a progression or a buildup of these toxic responses such that we finally get some sort of level of overt biological response or effect. So we cross a threshold, and that's key for systemic toxicology. We cross a threshold where we start observing clinical toxicosis. And so under that threshold, we're not seeing toxicosis. Our system is managing it. Now, these thresholds for effects can be a range of end effects. It can be, for example, lethality in some organisms. It can be, for example, if it's a pharmaceutical, there can be desirable end effects. For example, managing a disease that we want to have a positive end effect, but under a certain dose, you won't have that effect. So you have to have a certain clinical threshold that you have to cross in terms of the amount that's dosed. One of the key concepts to think about in terms of toxicosis is intrinsic activity, and that can be a response, and recognize that we are chemical beings. We are full of chemical responses, most of them favorable, and that's why we're here. But we can have intrinsic interactions of toxicants. Agonists are substances with intrinsic activity. So, for example, an agonist to oxygen, which we breathe and use in terms of our terminal electron acceptor in our respiration process, is an agonist. An antagonist is something that works against that. So carbon monoxide, which will bind our hemoglobin somewhat irreversibly relative to oxygen, is an antagonist. Okay? So agonist, antagonist, good terms to remember. In terms of a toxicant and a receptor, you've got some binding or some response here of the two coming together. Typically, we find if we classify pharmaceuticals, those are often regarded as reversible. Toxicants typically non-reversible. And what we find is that we can sustain a certain amount of toxic damage and rebuilding. And it all depends upon the type of exposure. Is it acute? Is it chronic? Is it something that is, for example, in the one molecule, one hit theory of cancer, All you need is one molecule of a carcinogen to modify this critical lesion to start this non-differentiated cellular process called cancer, and these cells will replicate. And so that is one model of our understanding of cancer. Give you an example here, since we started talking about oxygen, of agonist-antagonist interaction. You may or may not have heard of methemoglobin formation. This is sometimes referred to as blue baby syndrome. This comes to us because what happens is our hemoglobin, which is typically ferrous iron, is oxidized to ferric iron. You can see that in these blood stains here. This is normal blood, fairly bright red. You get this chocolate brown methemoglobinemia. What happens because there's reduced oxygen transport? That's why we get the blue baby in blue baby syndrome. We can have oxidation of ferrous iron by nitrates, and typically this is the active ingredient is actually a reduced form, nitrites, and this has to do with juvenile inability to manage nitrates sufficiently. Naphthalene, chlorates are also, and acetaminophen, which is on your analgesic shelf, are also chemicals that in high concentration can cause methemoglobin formation. Methemoglobin, and we have a certain amount of methemoglobin that forms normally and naturally. It's when we have too much that we go into respiratory distress. We just don't have the hemoglobin to transport oxygen in our. So what we find also is an antagonist impact of competition for oxygen binding. Carbon monoxide binds at the ferrous iron, as does cyanide. Cyanide typically in cellular respiration, whereas carbon monoxide is typically in pulmonary respiration. This is another form of toxicosis in terms of oxygen transport toxicants. In terms of methemoglobin formation, if we take a look at the heme group, we can see ferrous iron here. We convert that from a ferrous heme to a ferric heme. We go from the red blood to the chocolate brown blood, and the decreased ability for oxygen transport from hemoglobin with methemoglobin formation. There's several types of oxidants, as you saw on that list, that can cause methemoglobin formation. It's a quick diagnostic procedure in terms of clinical emergency medicine, in terms of looking for this particular endpoint of toxicosis. One of the things I will ask you to do on the course website in the lecture module here is to go into the protein data bank, and I'll give you some links for fetal hemoglobin and for bar-headed goose hemoglobin. This is a representation. This is a representation of the proteins involved in the hemoglobin molecule. You can see the heme groups down here. These are oxygen saturated. What's kind of neat and nifty about the protein data bank site is you can actually play with these molecules. You can rotate them around. And even though it's still a two-dimensional representation of these complex molecules and the helices of the peptides and the protein, it still will give you respect for the dimensionality of receptors. And I think that's a good thing to have, especially if you don't come from a strong chemistry background. But I want you to get into the protein data bank and just for your own edification, play with this. Rotate it around, look at what, you know, consider yourself to be a toxicant like a carbon monoxide. What would you have to do in terms of where you would have to go for the active site of the particular molecule? When we talk about toxicology, we are often talking about protein-chemical interactions. And so I want you to get a good idea for receptors, dimensionality of receptors, beyond perhaps just stick and ball drawings, get a little bit into dimensionality. We talked about the importance of toxicity rating. This quick chart gives you a classification, and this is oral human dose for average adults. Obviously, there's some concern, an increasing concern about these toxicity ratings for children. Children eat more on a body weight basis, and as well in terms of toxicity. They're developing many systems, their neurological systems, many of their overall processes are being developed early in their childhood. and so there can be these developmental impacts in children. But we can go from practically non-toxic, 15 grams per kilogram body weight, and that's more than a quart in terms of what the average adult dose would be. So you'd have to expose yourself significantly. We go into very toxic, where we get into the 50 to 500 milligrams per kilogram. And by the way, many people don't understand kind of mass conversions, especially in the U.S. where we're dealing with pounds and ounces. I always tell people to weigh a nickel. A nickel is about 5 grams. And so it's a good idea, for example, in terms of slightly toxic, you'd have to eat something about as heavy as a nickel for the average adult to be poisonous. So it's a macro quantity. You have to be exposed in a fairly massive way, as opposed to some of these extremely toxic or super toxic, less than 5 milligrams per kilogram. And so this is these acute hypertoxic materials, one drop, the things like botulism toxin. Finally, this gives you an idea of the spectrum of toxic doses, and this is something we'll talk about, LD50s, or the lethal dose for 50% of a population. This is typically in animal trials, and LD is lethal dose, once again. And this is milligrams per kilogram of body weight. And you can see, and Paracelsus tells us that the dose makes the poison, that even things like sodium chloride or table salt can have a lethal dose. So as you go from ethanol to sodium chloride to ferrous or iron sulfate, morphine, phenobarbital, we start getting into DDT, where we start getting into the 100 milligram per kilogram range. Picrotoxin is an alkaloid in plants. It's called the fishberry plant. I have a picture of it here. In Southeast Asia, they call it the fishberry because the particular seed pods of this particular plant, if you throw them into the water, it's a neuromuscular toxicant. It actually paralyzes fish. We learn about a lot of the toxicants in nature from indigenous peoples. Strychnine sulfate, the LD50, is 2 milligrams per kilogram. It's a neuroexciting drug. It actually has been used in the early parts of the last century as a doping stimulant in athletics. The early years of the Tour de France, for example, in bicycle racing, perhaps ancient history when compared to the modern doping concerns. But it would be not unusual for athletes to take wine doped with strychnine as a way to make it up a hill. Nicotine, if you're a cigarette smoker, the LD50 is 1 milligram per kilogram. The turbocurarine is a curare alkaloid from plant species Strychnos toxifera. In South America, curare poison arrow tips you see in the movies. It's a muscle relaxant toxicant. Tetrodotoxin, we'll talk about in one of our target organ, ecological biochemistry discussions. This is a toxin that comes through a dinoflagellate in marine environments that gets bioaccumulated up the marine food chain, such that the high predatory fish like groupers, barracuda, will have a high dose concentration in their tissues. This is a neurotoxin. Dioxin, especially TCDD, tetrachlorodibenzodioxin, the LD50, and this is a 1 microgram, not milligram anymore, 1 microgram per kilogram, so highly toxic. We'll talk about this in terms of its comparative toxicity aspects and some of the risk assessment challenges of dioxins in environmental toxicology. And finally, a toxin from bacteriogenesis, botulinus toxin. You can see that this is now in the order of 1/100th of a microgram And so the highly toxic protein, and this is obviously something to be avoided in terms of food preparation. Well, this gives you, I guess, a briefing of some of the concepts in toxicology. The idea here is, again, to try to give you a little bit of the familiarization of some of the terminology, some of the core definitions. It's a little over the top in terms of some of the conceptual understanding. I don't expect you necessarily to understand all of the terminology, toxicomechanics, toxicodynamics, because we will deal with separate lectures on many of these core subject areas. But I think it's always best for students to hear these concepts several times at an introductory light. So don't get frustrated in terms of your grasp of this. Don't be reaching for things. Your readings will introduce some of these concepts, but our further lectures will describe them as well. Next time, what we're going to do is a case study. And I try and do an early case study here in Principles of Environmental Toxicology to show you the application of some of the terminology, to introduce you how toxicology is used before we get into the guts, if you will, of the discipline and some of the sources, pathways, receptors, and controls concerns. We'll talk about pesticides and food residues. So what we won't talk about is non-target or off-target environmental impacts. We have to focus it somewhere, and we'll choose to focus it on foods for human consumption. Until that time, we'll see you again. Thanks.